You're listening to Midtown 150, Past Plates. Midtown spans about 5.5 miles south of downtown St. Petersburg. During segregation, it was one of the only areas in St. Pete where African Americans were allowed to live. The Neighborhood News Bureau at the University of South Florida St. Petersburg has covered Midtown for over a decade. I'm Tyler Gillespie, a teaching assistant for the class. Midtown became a food desert this past February when the neighborhood Walmart shut down. A food desert is basically an area that doesn't have easy access to vegetables, fruit, or healthy options. We wanted our first installment of our podcast to be about food history in Midtown. And our first story is going to take you to church.
Churches were the powerhouses behind historical movements and progression over the years.
That's Rod Cunningham. He's a local author and speaker.
Not only did these churches provide a place of spiritual outlook and resources, but they provided basic necessities such as housing and food to both its members and strangers on the street. One way the churches have ensured that people in the community don't starve is through Sunday dinner.
My name is Willie Washington. I've lived here in St. Pete all my life. I had an auntie named Rosalie Washington, and we live right over by Mercy Hospital on 13th Avenue. And everybody that came to the church used to come to my aunt's house to eat. So that's how I got to know everybody, was through the fact that after church, everybody was there. I wasn't going to church then, but I knew everybody because everybody came to eat.
My name is Roscoe Prince, Jr. I have been a member of the 20th Street Church of Christ since 1958. We would have wild game, we'd have fish, we'd have possum, we'd have coon. We just had a real good time. Good cornbread, and collard greens, and you name it.
So I'm LaWanna Washington. I am the chairperson of Women of Faith here at 20th Street. Throughout the year, there are several things that happen that maybe in the church, someone has a death in the family and they need support as far as funeral costs, or they need support in feeding the family. And it's just a way to help somebody, anybody. We don't ever want to say that, wow, we don't have anything to give you. Every Sunday, she cooks dinner and she invites like 15 to 20 people to her house. Just after church, just no cost, no anything, just the fellowship.
My first name is Archie. My last name is Barnes. My mother was a cooker, and from a child growing up, I was with her. When she would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and make biscuits or whatever, I would get up with her and be in the kitchen with her. And she was in a wheelchair, and she would cook everything. And that's how I learned to cook, was being in the kitchen with my mom.
But one thing about it, if you got some pretty good food, you can get some people around, and it brings people together. You get to know people, to understand them. Sometimes we just pass by people and don't never know them. But once you're sitting down eating and talking, you can learn so much about a person. And I think that's important. Food and some singing, some good singing, you can get some people.
Midtown used to be full of fresh fruit. People could just walk right outside their doors and pick a mango right from the trees that line the streets. But most of those mango trees are no longer there. Joseph Conti, Alyssa Fedorovich, and Andrea Perez went to find out where those mangoes have gone.
Walking down the dirt roads of 34th Street near Gibbs High School, Sylvester Norton Jr. remembers never having to worry about how he was going to find food, including the savory mango.
We had mango trees, mulberry trees. I mean, you had all kind of fruit, like we said, everything, you know. You don't have it right here now, but back then, I mean, you could survive.
Norton,
Yeah, no money much, but you didn't have to worry about something to eat.
Memories are triggered by the things recalled as life-altering moments. For residents of Midtown, these memories can spur from just hearing about one of their most beloved fruits, the mango. Back in 1961, a young Sierra Leonean knew she would find a sweet mango waiting for her near Rose Park Hill around school time.
Pull them off and peel them and eat them right then. We did. That's what we did. You know, we didn't make no salad or nothing like that because we was kids. You know, we didn't know how to make no salad. We just know how to eat them. We didn't even much wash them. We just peel them off and eat them right where we had them.
Throughout the 1950s and 60s, natives of Midtown enjoyed the ability to pick fruits, especially the abundant mango within footsteps of their homes and nearby blocks. Retired teacher Alvin Porter, who lived at 2100 9th Avenue South, remembers eating his favorite type of mango like it was yesterday.
Mangoes were very, very plentiful. One that I enjoyed most was what we call the pineapple. The lady finger was kind of long, but the pineapple was kind of roundish, oblong. It was firm. The ladyfinger was kind of soft and stringy. The pineapple wasn't that stringy, but it was delicious. I liked it.
Like Mr. Porter, Shirley's favorite type of mango was the pineapple. Both natives were always enthusiastic to pick them directly from the tree.
It's different kind of mangoes. It's ladyfingers and it's pineapple. I like the pineapple. The ladyfingers was stringy. They're stringy. But I like the pineapple because they solid. They don't break apart. And you don't get the strings all in your teeth. I can't stand it. That's why I like the pineapple the best.
They were all around. You can just walk around in the neighborhood and get a pole or something and knock mangoes down to the ground and get them and eat them. Because mangoes basically would grow on vacant lots and things of that nature, you know. As a matter of fact, there's one up here, but it's gone now. 927 22nd Street, that was a mango tree over there. But some kind of way it died out.
Midtown natives can still spot the tropical tree around the city, like older ones near Burlington Avenue North, but they don't grow in abundance anymore. Historians at USF explain the development in Midtown affected the growth of mango trees, but the fruit continues being an important symbol within the African American community, one that connects the past with the present by picking one at a time. Further to the southeast, near Bartlett Park on 4th Street South, Sherry Howard remembers helping her grandmother pick mangoes from her backyard.
My nana used to do this, like take the mango and bake it like for a little bit with a little bit of brown sugar and butter. And I think it was because we had so many abundance of them coming, growing in the yard. When they fall on, she'd go out there and pick them up and she would just make something out because she didn't believe in waste.
Like Sherry, Midtown natives have fond memories of picking mangoes. Rosalie Peck, a cherished St. Petersburg writer, once wrote that of all the readily accessible food sources of nature, mangoes are most affectionately remembered.
Back then, I mean, you could survive. I think about sometime if some of them people that died could come back and see what's going on now.
A lot of people in Midtown ride the bus. And now that the area is a food desert, this means that it's going to take them even longer to get to the grocery store. Let's listen to some of the folks who talked to NMB reporters Colin Holzberger and Brittany Cravata.
It's good for what it is to get you where you need to go. I think certain spots could be covered more because not some neighborhoods can use bus transportation.
Some days they're early, some days they're late. I plan my bus rides like a day before. So basically, I have to get to work at a certain time, and we got stuck in traffic. You know, a lot of people getting on the bus, a lot of people getting off. And so I was like almost 30 minutes late.
Now I have to either come way out here or go on 34th to go to a Walmart. That being there was very convenient for me. I think they should have found some more ways, security-wise, to protect their products and their merchandise, so to the point where they wouldn't close up. So I think they could have took more evasive actions to protect the store, because I don't think it shouldn't close. That's it done closed. Sweet Bay has closed. Like, what's store going to be able to come there and stay there and stay there for a long period of time, not just for 1 or 5 months?
Our next two stories are about one of my favorite things to do, and that's eat out. Midtown has a bunch of great restaurants, and our reporters went to two of them. Ryan Callahan checked out Mama Faye's on 16th Street South, and Grace Cunningham spent a day in Munch's, which is on 6th Street South.
That's the sound of Mama Faye's Deli, a popular corner store that sells homemade style food. Corey Ellis works in Mama Faye's kitchen and has been there for 22 years.
But breakfast and lunch, we start breakfast to 11:30, and then we start lunch at 11:30 to until the $2 holla, and you get 5 items. You get the corned beef hash, the grits, everything from scratch.
Charles Comer is 64 years old, and for him, Mama Faye's is part of his daily routine.
Every day, that's it. Every morning.
Every morning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coffee and breakfast every morning. Have a cigarette.
Jimmy Lyles also works in Mama Faye's kitchen. He's been there for 9 years. He says it's not just the cheap prices that attract customers, but also the cleanliness of the deli.
Oh, man, it's been a great impact, you know? A good, dependable place they can come get food, cheap food. One of the cheapest places in town. Good, clean, cheap food. And all the compliments that people have. We love your food. We love your service. Keep the place so clean, you know. That just makes us feel good, you know.
The year was 1952. The number one song in the country was a piece of instrumental concert music, and 20 cents could get you a gallon of gas. This is the year Dean and Clarice Munch opened Munch's Sundries and Restaurant in South St. Petersburg. They had two sons, Gary and Larry, who began working at the restaurant at young ages. Now, Larry owns and runs Munch's and has plenty of stories to tell from the restaurant's historic run in St. Petersburg.
My name is Larry Munch, and I'm the proprietor of Munch's Sundries and Restaurant. We've been here 65 years. Munch's Sundries was started by my parents back in 1952. It was just a sundry store. They used to sell paper supplies, books, school supplies, because there was Lakewood Elementary was across the street at the time. And that's how it all started. They just started with a hot dog machine and then eventually grew over the past 65 years into a full-fledged restaurant. My mom and dad, they used to open at 7 in the morning and work until 10 o'clock at night. At the time, my brother and I, we were just babies, lived across the street in an apartment, and they would take turns. When there was a lot of construction work being done around here, my mom would make sandwiches, and then they would take them out to the construction sites and sell them by the sandwich and sell cans of soda and water and coffee and tea and stuff like that. My grandfather was a fire captain, and so he would dabble around in real estate and stuff like that. They had found this piece of property, and when my parents got married, they gave him a down payment to come in here to get this place started. And he said this was the main artery going down. So from their wisdom and stuff like that and knowledge of the area, this is where they turned out to buy the property at. And we also do stuff with Lakewood Elementary across the street. Like when they have educational walks and stuff like that, they will come by here and we'll supply them with stuff. Yeah, it's been there for as long as I can remember. That's actually where my brother and I went to elementary school. That's an old Spanish-style school, no air conditioning, a lot of the old trees and stuff like that. Play field out beside it, because you always used to play kickball and badminton and all that kind of stuff. Tetherball, back when we were growing up. Back when, like I said, my parents were here all the time, so my brother and I started when we were young. I think I was probably 14 years old when I started bussing tables and washing dishes, and eventually moved over to cooking and that type of stuff. And I've been here for, I bought it from my mother 25 years ago. My father had passed away, and she was ready to retire, so I bought it from her. and I've owned it for the last 25 years. I've got people that's been eating here for 40 years.
David West has been eating at Munch's since he was just a kid, and he remembers growing up having Munch's as the place to go in the neighborhood.
Hello, my name is David West. I've been coming here probably since 1962. Growing up, at Mrs. Munch, we used to have charges, so we could come in here and eat and just give her the receipt and walk out the door. It's a local area where people can meet and talk and, you know, engage with each other.
We were on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives for our Texas Hash. That's something I came up with probably about 20 years ago. A lot of our specials, like our fried chicken, we've been serving that for, gosh, probably 50 years or so, something like that. And the shepherd pie and a couple of other things that we've been doing for years and years and years.
Our last story brings all these elements together, and it talks about food history from a chef's point of view.
Your name is Lorenzo?
Yes, ma'am, Lorenzo.
And do you mind talking to us out from USF?
At Chief's Creole Cafe, head chef Lorenzo Jackson sat down with the Neighborhood News Bureau to talk about training the next generation of great cooks. Something he learned by growing up near historic 22nd Street South in Midtown St. Petersburg, also known as the Deuces. Lisa Britton, Tracy Karp, Avery Spiegel, and me, Katie Wilcox, wanted to explore the culture of food from the perspective of those who make it, the chefs and restaurateurs.
Well, I work here at Chief's Creole Cafe. I've been working here about 2 years, right here in the Midtown area of St. Pete. My passion of cooking, it started with Granddad. It started brewing before I knew it was there. Spending a lot of time with him while my dad was away. And it just makes me reminisce about just growing up so many summers just out in the field with my granddad. He's sitting back drinking his beer. And throughout the years, it started his progression. I was getting trained my whole life to be a prep cook through him.
Lorenzo followed his grandfather's lead and continued his legacy by learning all he could about what makes food great. He's now passing along his knowledge to his 8-year-old son and training him to be the next great Midtown chef.
It's basically, yeah, the same things with my granddad. He's in there with me cooking the French toast. He's asking, why do I use vanilla extract and why does that and what does it do? And I keep him right behind me when I'm cooking. Yeah, so yeah, it's just like me all over again.
My name is Elihu Brayboy, owner of Chief's Creole Cafe.
Using food to help the community is more than a matter of pride. For Mr. Brayboy, it's both necessity and history.
As an African American, my view of failure of this enterprise, it goes deeper than just dollars and cents.
Mr. Brayboy's mother and grandmother inspired him to keep the spirit of food and cooking alive.
Well, my grandmother was a very great cook, mm-hmm. And then my mother became a very great cook. Okay. So I was raised in a household of great cooks. I would have let down all of the other generations who helped build something so that I could live a better life when I came home, because they had to live a terrible Jim Crow, racial prejudice. You and I wouldn't have been able to sit and talk like this. But now here we are 50 years later, able to have this conversation. If nothing else, I've learned this. Food is a tremendous platform to break down barriers. This is the time for us to really do what we're doing.
Next to Chief's Creole Cafe in Midtown, Deuce's Barbecue owner, Chef P.T. Collins, worked with Mr. Brayboy and took a gamble on the location, and it paid off.
For a white guy to open a barbecue joint in a black neighborhood is like, nobody...
White guy with a black soul.
Yeah, nobody would ever do that. It's not common.
Chef P.T. opened Deuce's Barbecue 2 years ago after Mr. Brayboy suggested renting the space next to the Creole Cafe. P.T. then saw a need in the community and wanted to give back to the people who have been so welcoming by teaching what he knew best, culinary skills.
I have been very proactive in involving the community, and as a result, the community has responded by accepting me and my restaurant here.
Just like Mr. Brayboy, P.T. feels that passing down his knowledge is a way of giving back to the people in Midtown. Both men help the community by giving a chance to those who may have been overlooked otherwise.
I'm also the chairman of the board for the St. Pete Culinary Center. That's a new culinary school that we've put together with a lot of other top chefs in the area. And so the program targets at-risk youth, like 16 to 24 years old. Maybe have been through the court system before and wouldn't be able to qualify for like a traditional school, like going to PTEC or whatever, because of the record that they had. And
Neighborhood News Bureau reporter Lisa Britton sat down with Mr. Brayboy later and asked if he thought the culinary program's ripple effect of passing down the skill is part of the spirit of Midtown.
Oh, absolutely. It's the spirit of Midtown, because when you have a reason, a purpose to achieve something. See, Lorenzo comes from, like you say, his grandfather taught him some food skills. If he can't expose you to that, then that kind of dies with him. But his grandfather made sure he passed it on to him, and now his job is to pass it on to the marketplace, to the universe. And that's what we're doing, is passing it on.
Well, that's it for our first podcast installment. We've only helped tell a few of Midtown's food stories, and there are so many more out there. If you'd like to share a Midtown story with us, please contact us through nnb@usfsp.edu or call 727-873-4856. Students who worked on stories for this podcast include Lisa Brittain, Angelina Bruno, Ryan Callahan, Joseph Conti, Brittany Cravata, Grace Cunningham, Lee Olston, Alyssa Fedorovich, Evie Guerrera, Colin Holtzberger, Tracy Karp, Paola Mazzini, Zoe McLean, Abigail Payne, Andrea Perez, Nicole Sawyer, Avery Spiegel, Catherine Wilcox, and Tamirica Williams. With special thanks to WUSF News Director Mary Shedden, NNBTAs Indira Suera Acosta and Zanina Mogel, and of course, NNB Professor Dr. Bernardo Moda. The song used throughout our podcast is Arnie Hoosby's Warm Duck Shovel, which is off his self-titled album. Please check back with us for more installments of our podcast series, and thanks for listening to Midtown 150, Pass Plates. For the Neighborhood News Bureau, I'm Tyler Gillespie.